You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me Dan Oliver. He's with me once again. He is the founder and manager and director of Mermican Capital, LLC. Thank you, Dan, for joining me again.
Thanks for having me.
You know, it's I was really looking over your October 11th article titled Heads or Tails You Lose, and I thought it might be great to start out today with that, just going over that, the basic idea behind that essay. I really want to talk to you about whether or not you think we can have a bounce back in the gold share markets in 2019, and if so, why. But before we get to that, I think very appropriate this article in terms of where we're at now in the gold market. We've had a 10-year bull market. The equity markets are certainly getting long in the tooth by historical standards. And yet, equity markets, of course, aren't the most important markets. I think the most important markets are the debt markets. And the debt markets, to me, look even more stretched, perhaps, than the equity markets. But could you start out, perhaps, by talking a little bit about martingale risk, which you pointed out in that article, Heads or Tails You Lose. Talk to us about martingale risk and then why that might be relevant to where the equity markets and the debt markets are today.
Yeah, so what a martingale risk is it's a bet where the chances of success are very, very, very high, but the prize for winning is very low. And conversely, the chances for loss is very low, but what you lose when you do lose is very, very high. And so it what it does is people who take martingale risk, especially investment advisors, they appear to be geniuses, right? If my business is selling asteroid insurance and I collect premiums all day long, I'm getting this money, this constant flow of income, the steady gains, right? I look like a genius until, of course, the asteroid hits and then I get wiped out. Actually, in that case, no one's around to collect. And it's not a bad analogy because that's essentially what AIG was doing in the housing market, right? They were selling insurance against a housing crash, and so they were getting steady income. And so each little bet with the chances of it going sour is very, very low because we were in a credit bubble and housing prices were going up. And housing prices, Bernanke told us, had never gone down nationwide. So what a safe, wonderful bet. Of course, until housing did crash. And they had enormous losses, wiping out all their gains. And of course, as we all know, they needed a bailout from the Fed. And the point is that professional investors can use martingale risk to snooker investors into thinking that they're geniuses. And to your point, the debt markets, because I think it's a good thing to talk about right now, is the hottest thing in the debt markets in this cycle is not mortgage bonds and mortgage-backed securities. It's business loans. So as you know, companies have been borrowing lots of money at very, very low interest rates to go buy back their shares. And the reason they do this is because the executives have stock options. So if they buy their shares back, it pushes the share price up and they get rich personally. So this is why they do it. But they make their capital structure more brittle. But then you ask, well, who lends the money to these guys? I mean, who's actually subsidizing this? And again, right. If it's not your money, right, if you're an agent and you're lending someone else's money, like a pension fund's money or someone else's money, as long as it performs, you get a big bonus. Mm-hmm. And so as long as things can work out for not 20 years maybe, but 2 or 3 or 4 years and you get your bonus, you don't really care what happens after that. I'm not aware of anyone at AIG who had to turn over their personal fortunes, turn their personal fortunes from their malfeasance that they did. Mm-hmm. The biggest part, the sexiest part, of the debt markets over the last few years has been called something called levered loans. So, I thought loans were leveraged. What's a levered loan? What a levered loan is it's a loan to a company that already has a debt burden of above 6x EBITDA, right? So you're talking about a company that's already has too many loans, and now we're getting them more loans, right?
Wow.
So as you can imagine, the interest rate on levered loans are very, very high, right? Because they're super risky. So again, Bernanke even announced the whole point of QE was to push people out of treasury bonds and into the stock market, into corporate debt, other more risky things. That's why he did it, to revive the economy, quote unquote. Well, of course, when that happened, when dollars in treasuries had to buy corporate bonds. People in the corporate bond market got pushed out, had to sell, and they had to buy something more riskier to maintain their yields. So this is why this market exists, because they had pushed investors into this super high risk market. What's scary about this is, until about 6 months ago, the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, had a rule that prevented banks from engaging this activity. And they did it because they thought it was too risky for banks to do it. So who was doing it? Well, this is the shell game. The banks would lend money to third-party operators, and the third parties would lend these money out. So the bank credit was still funding it just through a third person, through party.
Wow.
And so the banks would say, hey, look, we don't have any levered loans in our balance sheet. Aren't we great? And we're just running around saying how strong the banks are because their balance sheet looks so great. Well, yeah, they don't have the levered loans. They have the loans to the people making the levered loans. So it's not quite as risky. There's some capital buffer in those third-party non-bank lenders, but they still ultimately are funding this thing and bear the risk. It gets a lot crazier, Jay, because what happened was two things. First of all, 6 months ago, the OCC withdrew its guidance. So right at the top of the market, when this stuff is super crazy, the banks, you know, jumped into this market. Actually, three things. That's number one. Number two is loans come with covenants. And the function of a covenant is like an income covenant. If the company's income goes below a certain percentage of its debt, it's an event of default. And the banks can run in and seize the collateral and sell it. And the reason covenants exist is because if you're an executive or an owner of a company and you reach the point of insolvency, what that means is you haven't been shut down yet. You owe more money than you have, right? So your equity value is zero at this point. So, you know, what is your natural incentive to do? Well, take the whole thing, go to Vegas and put it on red.
Right.
In other words, take a big bet, right? And if it goes red, you double the money. And you get rich, the equity guy, because you go to the upside. If it lands on black, well, it's not your money anyway. The bank takes the loss. And so the point of the covenant is to prevent management teams from doing that, right? It's saying, look, once you hit a certain point, we know you're going to turn into rank speculators. We don't want you to be gambling our money, right? And so we're going to shut you down. Well, because of the hot debt markets, companies were able to negotiate better and better terms. And the percentage of levered loans that are covenant light, so called. They don't have this covenant protection.
Right.
It's 80% now. It's 80%.
Wow.
So what that means is that when things start going south, the managers, the banks can't shut them down. So the managers can keep dialing up the risk to try to save their own skins while they're betting with someone else's money, the bank's money or whoever it is that engages in these things. Mm-hmm. So you've got this super toxic bunch of loans, and it gets worse. Because, of course, what the banks do, what banks do, and also people like KKR and Blackstone, is they take pools of these levered loans and they put them into securitized instruments, just like housing.
Yeah.
They say, hey, look, well, you know, maybe one company might blow up, but there's no way that all of them can blow up at the same time, even though they're super risky. The idea is if we've got a pool of them, then the top tranches, the guys who get paid off first, can't lose, right? So they get a AAA-rated security based on a pool of these crazy levered covenant light levered loans, right? So I know it's a sort of a complicated step to follow, but then it gets worse than this, even worse. And that is, I've been told by two people who are in this market. I haven't read this anywhere, but I've been told by two people who actually operate them that the latest innovation of this thing in the last couple of years is that the so-called BP. So when you set up a securitization structure, as you probably know, Jay, you put a bunch of debt into a structure, but by definition, the APs gets that paid out first. You say, well, they're not all in default, and then the last guy is called the BPs, and he takes the most risk and he gets the most return. So if everyone pays back, he makes a ton of money. If people default, he takes the hit first. Well, after the financial crisis, the rules were changed so such that the issuer, the bank or KKR, whoever it is, has to keep the BPs. They were saying, hey, you've got to keep some of this risk on your balance sheet so you don't make crazy loans. Well, what they did was they structure these things such that the BPs has the right to sweep out dividends of excess cash flow from the company.
Wow.
Let's think about this. So as long as the company is doing well, the BPs gets all the cash. They get their capital back through cash flows. And once it blows up, right, well, there's no collateral. There's not going to be any collateral left. Because again, you can't shut these things down because they don't have covenants, and the operators, the management, is going to keep betting and keep betting, keep betting more and more aggressively until it's all gone. And so And then you ask yourself, well, who owns this stuff? And again, it's people like European pension funds who can't speak English and haven't read the, mm-hmm. the fine, haven't read hired the right lawyers, mm-hmm. or anyone looking for AAA, or you're some pension fund in the U.S., you got to buy AAA rated paper, Treasury yields so little, these things yield more. You say, well, it's AAA rated, I'll get it, right? Just like housing. Well, yeah. No. I mean, it's backed by a pool of things that, and this is the key point, it is correlated, right? When you start dialing up interest rates, what happens is that these things become really hard to roll. Your levered loan might have a term of only 2, 3, or 4 years. Mm-hmm. And so term is now you get to roll it. So maybe your last interest rate was I don't know, 6 or 7%. And yep. It says, okay, if you want to take out today, it's going to be 10%. Mm-hmm. Now I can't afford that.
Yeah.
So that's sort of a macro market problem that the authorities have allowed the structure to exist. And let's just run through a quick example or two of how this plays out in the real world. And that is looking at companies like GE and GM. Okay. Right. So we all know that, I presume most of your listeners understand the basics of Austrian business cycle theory. So
yes.
The banks run out, they create all this credit, they push asset prices higher, which pushes discount rates lower, right? And when you have mm-hmm. a long-term cash flow like a ship or a building, or the long-term cash flow is the more influenced it is by changes in discount rates. And that's mm-hmm. why
sure.
every bubble results in too much building of real estate and ships and airplanes and airports, all mm-hmm. that sorts of thing. So rates go down. What happens is you stimulate demand for things like cars and jet engines and locomotives and power plants. In other words, the products that companies like GM and GE produce. Now, when you're talking about big capital projects like that, products, there are very few producers. And so what happens is that people start bidding these things, and so the prices go through the roof, and so these companies make huge amounts of cash flow, right? Mm-hmm. At the same time that their cost of capital is falling, because yeah. how do they fund themselves in the debt market?
Right.
Right? It's just, this is great. So their equity goes crazy because their costs are going down, their cash is going up, and then the management team takes the money, the cash, and buy back their shares. So the number of shares are shrinking. I mean, that's why these big, huge companies do incredibly well. But now let's put that in reverse, mm-hmm. right? So let's say, so now the Fed is jacking rates higher. And so what happens to a company like GE is, well, all of a sudden the demand for these super long-term capital items like locomotives and generators collapses, right? So they got all the sort of capacity that they built to satisfy the earlier demand. Now all of a sudden they've got no pricing power at all because no one wants these
yep.
things. At the very same time that their cost of capital is going shooting higher because they borrowed this debt, not just to fund the business, but to fund the share buybacks. So GE was, borrowing money to buy back their share in the high 20s, of their stock share price. And now mm-hmm. it's in the 60s. And now it's in the single digits.
Yeah.
Right. But they still have the debt. The debt's still
there. They still have the debt. That's the point.
And what's worse, it's not just the Fed, right? Because what's happened now is that everyone looks at a company like GE and they say, whoa, I don't run this company money. So their cost of capital goes through the roof. And all of a sudden, they can't run their business. And people I talk to think it's an open question whether a company will survive or not. GM is not as extreme, but again, the same thing happens. The demand for cars craters all of a sudden when they can't offer 0% financing. Now they actually got to borrow the money at a cost. They got to charge the consumer that cost, and so the free ride's gone away. At the same time, their cost of capital is going up, and so what do? They shut a plant. They shut their plants down. And mm-hmm. what happens is all the employees in that plant who maybe were making good wages and maybe they took out loans because they had to buy houses because houses have gone up so much in price. You can't buy a house in cash. You got to take a huge mortgage. So mm-hmm. not necessarily being irresponsible. They were just being realistic. And they had the same thing with their car, same thing with the college education for their yeah. for their kids. So they're swimming in debt. And all of a sudden now, again, rates have gone up and their job went away. Right. And so this is what the Fed has done. The bubble infects not just businesses, but people's lives and their dreams and everything else. And then they dial the rates up. And I mean, I don't have a huge high opinion of Trump's intellectual abilities. I think he's a very cunning fellow. But he understands that rising rates is going to kill this economy and this market. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, as they don't raise rates, you got other problems, i.e.
Yep.
more of your capital is stuck in malinvestments. You wind up in huge amounts of inflation, hyperinflation. So, I mean, this is the point. This is what Mises wrote about, decades ago, which was that once you get to this position, your choices are only you keep printing money into hyperinflation or you stop printing the money and you get a huge crash. And that's precisely where we are. But I hope this conversation, this presentation, has helped sort of identify exactly where the how the structure has been created and why it's so vulnerable and just how bad it can be. Right, it's not necessarily that GE's assets are down 90% in value. Right, mm-hmm. The assets are very different. The equity gets what's left over after the debt gets paid. And right. So you could have a situation where the assets go down by only half, but your equity goes down by 95% because
right.
you
get so much debt. Levered, too much leverage.
It's so
leveraged. I think, Dan, I think you've really...
The market can, I mean, people don't understand this. The S&P 500, everyone was playing this game to some extent or other. And so this is how you get a 90% decline in the broader markets, right? It's not because the world ends and the economy stops. It's not like GDP plunges by 90%. It's because all these companies have levered themselves up so much that the equity in them is very, very vulnerable. And I think people really, really need to understand that that's how this system works.
All right. Well, that's I think heads or tails you lose. I think you've just explained that very well in real terms. And what is, you know, Dan, as you were talking, the only thing I could think of is orgy. It's like a financial orgy, and everybody's having a party until it ends, and then it's a hellish scenario, and we saw that in 2008. So do you see something of a similar nature unwinding again?
No, I don't, Jay. I think it's going to be much, much worse. I think it's going to be worse because the debt levels are higher than they were in 2008. Remember, 2008 was a debt problem. There was too much debt in 2007, and they solved it by adding more and more debt. So the whole world, it's not just the U.S., it's the whole world. I think it's going to be worse this time than it was in 2008. It won't just be housing. It'll be businesses at large and housing, too, of course. That has its own – the structures of there have gotten pretty pernicious, too. With the same thing, banks are funding third-party lenders who go out and issue 98%. One guy – there's a company doing 101% mortgages. You actually get money back when you buy a house. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. I think it's going to be worse.
Okay, so – how do we prepare for this? I mean, what do we do? The last time, 2008, 2009, can we use that as a measure, even though you're seeing it a magnitude worse this time around when this thing comes down? Last time, immediately, everything lost value, all assets, including gold and silver, everything went down initially. And then we started QE, massive amounts of QE for the first time, and then, of course, QE2, QE3, et cetera, QE infinite.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we have had QE infinite in essence until now. They're trying to stop it. Powell would like to put the brakes on it, but he can't quite do it. A couple of weeks ago, we did see some possible signs of a capitulation from Powell and his. Do you think he flinched a little bit there? And do you think how soon do you think we might come into sort of capitulation by the Fed chairman again? How much worse does it have to get?
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, I think you have to understand that if you look at the world through the dollar lens, you're looking at a very distorted picture, right?
Uh-huh.
What happened in 2008 is the dollar, there was a massive short squeeze in the dollar. And so, yes, the dollar got bid because people needed dollars. They had so much debt. And so prices in dollar terms plummeted for a bit of time. And I think that could certainly happen. I mean, certainly will happen in the broader markets, in the debt markets again. It's already starting to happen, I think. But if you look at the world through gold terms, I think you get a clearer view of value. And so gold's purchasing power actually went up. I mean, don't forget that, again, if we look at gold through the dollar view, gold got hit by 30%.
Yeah.
But oil went down by 80%. So, in fact, the world through the gold lens, the dollar got really strong, which it did because of a short squeeze, and dollar and the cost of living plummeted. So you were fine in gold. Not if you're a dollar bug, but if you're a purchasing power mm-hmm. person, then you were fine. And then, of course, what the Fed had to do is go liquidify the system by doing the $5 trillion of guarantees and then QE. And then the dollar collapsed, i.e. gold went up, but really the gold didn't go anywhere. Gold is stable, right? What happens is the dollar went down. And they did that intentionally because only with a very cheap dollar could the massive debtors repay their debts. And who is the biggest debtor on the planet? It's the federal government. So they can't let the federal government default. So you know at some point. I mean, that is That is the function of the Fed, is to make sure the bank system survives to fund the government. You know, as a quick aside, Jay, if we have time, I was looking at, as you know, I'm writing a book on history of credit bubbles, and
right.
I discovered, you know, where in the Constitution does it say that the government has, the federal government has the power to charter banks? And the answer is it doesn't say it. The power is not there. So how can they do it? Well, they do it because the original argument that Hamilton gave, and that was repeated in Maryland versus in the Second Amendment of the United States, and then again in the 1860s, was that it's an incidental power to raising taxes and funding the military, i.e. the only legal basis for the banking laws in this country is because the banks create a market for treasury bonds to fund the government. That's it. That's their legal function. The other stuff they do is an aside, but that's why they're allowed to exist and do what they do. So the point is that there's no chance that the Fed is going to allow the banks to crater to a point where the federal government can't fund itself. And so you know they're going to come in and print the money. What you don't know is when, right? I mean, you're mm-hmm. right. You know, Powell was saying in early October, hey, we're the rates are a long way from neutral. We can do lots more increases. And then a month left later, the markets started tacking. He said, oh, my goodness, no, we're right up there. We're right near the neutral rate. I think at some point the markets will keep going down and Powell will have to do an embarrassing about face and start printing the money again. The question is when? Or will he try to sneak in one more rate increase to show he's in charge? I don't know the answer to that, but what I do suspect is that the longer he waits to react, the worse it'll be, because defaults create cross defaults, right? I default to you, you default to your lenders.
Yeah, exactly.
The longer you let that go, the more effort you need, the more you get a print to stop it. And so the longer he delays doing QE again, printing money, I think the worse it's going to be. But think about how intellectually humiliating that's going to be for all the authorities.
So I
suspect that we have quite a bit of room to fall before the Fed will face the intellectual humiliation of having to do an about face and start printing money again.
All right. Well, Dan, what I wanted to find out from you is what your thoughts are about the gold markets and the gold share markets this year. I guess in part, again, it's one of timing. Alistair MacLeod, who's a frequent guest on this show, was quite convinced that the thing would start coming unraveled this year before the end of this year is over. And I think we're seeing some signs of that. The equities are starting to show some wear. And there's, I think, some trouble, big trouble in the debt markets already, especially in the more leveraged markets, as you're talking about. But are we going to see a turnaround in the gold share markets this year, 2019?
I think so. I mean,
I certainly hope so.
But I also think so. I mean, and the reason is because what I've noticed is that whenever you see really big down days in the S&P 500, gold gets bid. Maybe it doesn't go up a lot, but it doesn't go down. I mean, it sort of sits there. Mm-hmm. So, the big question has been, well, is it going to be like, as you point out, 2008, where in the first crisis, gold gets hit and then in dollar terms and then shoots higher when they react, or does it go straight higher? And I've been ooching towards the latter only because back in 2008, you had lots of momentum players who were levered long in the gold market, in the gold trade, and in the gold companies. And when they got redemptions and margin calls, they had to dump what they had to dump. And you don't see that in the market. Gold's been in a downtrend for so long. I think, if anything, that the managed money is short gold. So when they get margin calls, they're going to go buy it. So I don't think gold it happens. It could happen. I mean, you could see metal discord from other places like China and India, where people take out debts and loans in gold terms and have to dump physical in the market. But I don't think so. I think that gold will go up. I don't know. I think it will. And of course, then at that point, the miners will participate. I mean, I hope that this year of pain, I mean, we've all been, it's very been a very painful year.
Absolutely.
It's setting us up for a price at which these things can really, really run. And that's also what happened in 2009, right? These things went down 90%, some of them. They hit rock bottom, and then they just took off. I hope we're nearing a similar point. I don't know that, and so I don't use financial leverage because I could be wrong about that. And we could go lower first. And I don't want to get a margin call and then be out of the trade when it takes off.
Yeah.
I'm convinced it's going to go a lot higher when the Fed reacts, and I think it'll go before that, but I don't know that, and so I make sure I'm able to withstand whatever happens, so I can be around for that outcome.
Daniel, just one last question because we are basically out of time here. What about what kind of gold mining companies do you like to invest in this market? I mean, we're at the bottom. I'm looking at a lot of these companies that they have millions of ounces in the ground in some cases, selling for pennies. The stocks are just absolutely decimated. Nobody wants them. Nobody understands gold as Austrians do, of course. And that may be one of the reasons. The market realities are going to have to hit people upside the head, I think, before they'll start to look at these things. Yeah. But in this kind of environment, do you take a different position than you might if you thought we were closer to the end of a gold bull market?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think what will happen is, what usually happens is, when gold takes off, the producers see benefits to cash flow immediately. And so their stocks are usually pretty tied in terms of timing with the gold itself. And the little juniors, they take longer because they have value, not because the gold, you can't produce the gold, you can't produce cash flow, but it has an asset. And so at some point you get capital flowing in from them, from the cash producing companies to acquire these things and fund them. And don't forget that the average mine life, mine reserves of the majors has shrunk from 11 years to 8 years over the past 5 years because they haven't had enough cash flow to reinvest in their own businesses. And so when they get cash flow again, they're going to need to go out and do that and acquire some of these things. So I think there'll be a scramble for these little tiny juniors that you're talking about. I don't think it happens immediately, but I think it does happen. And when it happens, as you know, these things can really go like Roman candles because they're so cheap right now. And the key thing is finding companies that aren't going to blow out their share structure while you're waiting for that to happen. I worry about the juniors.
I agree with you. Boy, the dilution factor is the killer for the juniors. And so, of course, that's what you focus on in your fund and what I try to do in my newsletter and on this radio show as well. Dan, I want to thank you so much for your wisdom, for sharing your insights with us. And I wish you a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And I hope to talk to you again sometime next year, perhaps, early, hopefully.
Thanks,
all right, well, folks, that is all the time we have for this week. Until talk to you again on January 8th, 2019, let me wish all of you a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
A gold rush has begun. Recently, three of the largest gold mining companies announced strategic acquisitions in the Yukon Territories. Ahead of them was a group who had already consolidated the key claims covering the historic Klondike Gold Rush into one company, aptly named Klondike Gold Corp. Led by a team of accomplished geoscientists, the company is steadily advancing exploration to reveal the rich source of all that gold. The hunt for the next major discovery is well underway, and Klondike Gold's shareholders are strategically positioned. Stay ahead of the majors and follow KlondikeGoldCorp.com.
Often referred to as one of the best teams in junior gold exploration, having discovered a 5 million ounce gold mine and sold a second company amidst discovery, the management behind Orin Resources now has a world-class exploration portfolio within Canada and Peru, projects that give the company one of the largest direct pipelines for major discoveries globally, with one of the deepest technical teams to explore them. Entering into its third year of aggressive pursuit, Orin is expecting results from two of their major projects throughout the rest of this year. For the latest, head to orinresources.com and subscribe.